The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's roundtable, where we look back over the big stories of the week with three crack political reporters. Well, if you think the coronavirus is over, think again. This week, both the Boston Marathon and the world's largest outdoor rodeo in Cheyenne, Wyoming, were canceled, a sure sign that we're not out of the woods yet. Plus, as every state begins to reopen, over a dozen states report more cases and more deaths from the pandemic. In other news, Twitter slaps Donald Trump on the wrist, and he lashes back. Joe Biden emerges from his basement wearing a mask. Minneapolis on fire after yet another unarmed black man is killed by a white police officer. And Donald Trump, yes, Donald Trump, accuses Joe Scarborough of murder. A lot to chew on for this week's panel, so let's get started. Addie Baer joins us, political reporter for BuzzFeed. Hello, Addie.
Hi, Bill.
Sam Baker joining us for the first time, healthcare editor at the great Axios. Hello, Sam.
Hey, Bill.
Good to have you with us. And Jason Dick back again, deputy editor of Roll Call. Hi, Jason.
Howdy, Bill. Good to be here.
All right. So, coronavirus, as big as it is, I want to start with the breaking news today, which is out of Minneapolis for the third night in a row. The protests continued, and the protests each night have turned more violent. We've seen now stores looted, stores burned, cars and trucks set on fire, even one of the police precinct stations where the four officers were assigned set on fire last night. The National Guard has been called in. The four police officers have been fired, but no charges leveled against them as yet. And overnight, Donald Trump called the protesters thugs and said, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, at which point Twitter censored, if you will, or at least put a flag on his tweet saying he was glorifying violence. We've seen this so often before. But Jason, what is it in the 21st century? There is still so much white police officer on unarmed black man killing.
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, part of it is that it doesn't seem to change, regardless how shocking the latest incident is. It just never seems to change the equation, and we get another one. And I don't know if it's a kind of a lack of self-awareness. I can't help but think that every police department, regardless of how big or small, is doing some kind of training, you know, about how to diffuse situations or how to just not be, you know, stupid in your line of work and needlessly like incite violence. I think that that's the issue that we're dealing with. I don't know why it doesn't change, but certainly the reaction is one of like, you know, why do we keep seeing this like with such like kind of sickening regularity?
And Sam, what struck me and still strikes me as so incomprehensible is why. So the one police officer clearly was choking this guy, and the guy is begging to be able to breathe. And the other three police officers just stand there.
Yeah, I mean,
why no reaction?
I don't know. That shocks me too. And it feels like there are no answers to any of this, or no satisfactory ones. You hate to paint with a broad brush, but it seems like sort of a cultural problem within law enforcement. You know, we've seen this in so many different cities, in so many parts of the country, but with so many similar circumstances. And, you know, I guess the political response, firing the officers, is a little bit more, is a little bit better this time, you know, as opposed to some of the digging in that we've seen in the past. But that's kind of giving a lot of credit for what I think a lot of people would fairly consider baby steps. So,
Addie, this was a time perhaps when the president could have said, look, this is outrageous what happened. We're going to get to the bottom of it. But in the meantime, please stay home or at least protest peacefully. That's what's called for here. Instead, the president went out, called the protesters thugs, and basically called on the National Guard to open fire on them. Is Trump blowing another opportunity?
Oh, I mean, obviously. But also, in some ways, it's one of those classic Trump things where you are both stunned and feel like, what else were you supposed to expect? Like, there was no chance that Donald Trump was going to react to this as the sort of consoler in chief that, you know, most people believe the president ought to be. And at the same time, it was, when I first saw that tweet last night, I honestly thought that it was not real. It was shocking to me.
And yet it was Donald Trump, right?
And yet it was real. Yeah.
And I feel like, Bill, you know, that one of the things that's sort of comes out in times of crisis, whether it's, you know, a war or whether it's a plague like we're dealing with, is that people become more of themselves. They lean into who they are. And I mean, this, I'm not trying to be an amateur psychologist here, but it seems like, you know, the president has not changed his approach. If anything, he has intensified it. He falls back on the things that are familiar to him. And this is the stuff that he feels comfortable with.
I think that's a really, really good way of saying it, Jason.
And I couldn't help but think back to Charleston, white protesters, walking through the streets, the Jews shall not replace us. One woman killed in their actions, and the president praised them as some very fine people. Here you have African American protesters in Minneapolis. The president calls them thugs and says they ought to be shot. Sam, pretty clear example of racism on the part of a man we've seen signs of racism before.
I mean, you can go all the way back to the Central Park Five before he was ever in politics. And, you know, like when there would be no sort of what does Donald Trump think about this? Like no one would care in the way that we care when he's the president. But yeah, he's always been, I mean, comfortable to say the least, using race as a wedge issue to sort of put it coldly and leaning into racial division.
And of course, I just want to be sure everyone knows this does come fast on the heels of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery down in Georgia, not by police officers, by two vigilantes, if you will. Again, a young unarmed black man. And in that case, is all three people, men in that incident have been charged with murder. I hate to drag this down to the political level, but Addie, there may be one other victim of the violence in Minneapolis, and that could be Amy Klobuchar. When she was district attorney of Minneapolis, she did not prosecute this same police officer who it looks like committed murder on the video. She failed to prosecute him when he had been charged in yet another, he and some other officers, in yet another act of violence against African-Americans in Minneapolis. Having let him go then, isn't that going to be very hard to explain for Amy Klobuchar today?
Oh, I certainly think so. During the primary, there was a lot of discussion about right. Kamala Harris's history in law enforcement, and I think a less of a conversation about Amy Klobuchar's
A little bit, not a lot, right?
Yeah, it was not a lot. I think that you're absolutely on the money that if she were to be chosen as Joe Biden's running mate in this moment, that conversation would get very loud very quickly. I think that it would be a really, I think you're right. I just don't think that this is, I think this is gonna, like you said, it's sort of gross to even quite talk about the politics, and I'm stuttering even over it as I talk, but I agree with you. I think it is not a good look for Amy Klobuchar.
It is the reality, isn't it, Jason? I mean, she's basically out of the running today.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll say too, that the, you know, in when Amy Klobuchar was making her, you know, first foray into federal politics, you know, when she was running in 2006, I mean, this was the thing that was looked upon as the winning combination. You know, she was a woman, she was a crime fighter, you know, she was, you know, her resume was the selling point. It wasn't just that she was a fresh face. And she won easily in that race. So I think that your resume and your accomplishments and your legislative record and your prosecutor's record are all fair game, negative or positive, for your opponents. And it, you know, we don't get a lot of do-overs in situations like this. But I mean, I don't know if she's done, you know, completely in electoral politics. I wouldn't go that far, but certainly, you know, with, you know, the Joe Biden is well aware that he has his own Achilles heel because of his support of, you know, anti-crime legislation in the 90s, get tough stuff, mandatory sentencing and so forth. And so I don't think that he's going to, you know, I wouldn't think that he would put somebody on the ticket who has the same weaknesses. I mean, he knows that he needs to have somebody who will compliment him and not raise more questions.
All right. So now let's move into the coronavirus pandemic. We are week number 11 since the president said this is a major crisis facing the country. 11 weeks we've been at it. 1.8 numbers I saw this morning, the latest 1.8 million cases now in the United States, 103,000 dead, and 41 million Americans, one out of every four American workers out of a job. So Sam, as the healthcare editor of Axios, you've been doing great reporting on this. Where are we now? Are we now on the down curve, or are we still climbing? How do you see it?
It sort of depends what kind of timeline you want to look at. Like right now, yes, we are on the down curve. The number of cases in the U.S. is going down, which is great, obviously. But we're not at the end of this. We don't really know where we are sort of in the story of coronavirus, but there's a good chance we're still in the first act. So, you know, in the immediate term, things are getting better nationwide. Things are getting better in most states, which is good news, not all states, but most of them. But, you know, we know nothing's really changed, right? Like, the virus didn't get weaker in the summer like people thought. We didn't find a treatment. The only thing that's happened, we did one intervention, which was the lockdown. It mostly worked, as, you know, sort of stunning as it is to say that 100,000 deaths is a, you know, the product of something that worked. But we don't know what comes next. So we're in uncharted territory here, and the number of cases could easily go back up.
And Jason, we've seen that in some areas. For example, I just saw last night in Alabama, which was one of the first ones to reopen, they've had 5,000 new cases in the last 14 days. So have we moved maybe too soon, too fast? Too far, too fast, I guess. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, it seems like, you know, on one hand, you've got cities like New York and Washington and in areas of the country who are trying to figure out a way to get to safely, you know, reintroduce, you know, life, you know, to people. And that's been a painstaking process. But on the other hand, you have people just saying like, you know, we need to do this and it's just happening. And it seems like a little haphazard in some parts of the country. And I don't know enough about Alabama's healthcare system and so forth to say that they messed it up by doing or not doing something. But, you know, if you look at just the way that we're approaching it it's very decentralized. It's exactly like the American political system is set up, and that has its real blind spots. And you know that, I mean, I'm sure some of you also follow Andy Slavitt with his podcast and Twitter as the former head of Medicare and Medicaid in the Obama administration. And you know, his latest missives last night were about how, you know, in Florida they seem to have gotten COVID under control, but they happen to have a pneumonia spike, and it's like, you know, there may be people who are just being exposed to this. Maybe they're not getting to the hospital. Maybe they're, you know, it just seems like like Sam says, we're still in chapter one and we're at 100,000 deaths. And just to put it into context, you know, in the 1918 influenza epidemic that killed 50 million people worldwide, you know, about 675,000 Americans are recorded as dying by the CDC. But that's a real rough estimate because so many people died without proper reporting. It could be much higher than that. In the 57 flu epidemic, 100,000 Americans died. In the 68 flu epidemic, another 100,000 Americans died. So, you know, we're past these sort of grim milestones for the endpoints of those previous epidemics, which is really scary.
And Addie, when we did pass this milestone today, one that President Trump insisted we would never reach, but when we did pass it today, I thought it was interesting the reaction on the part of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Joe Biden, from his basement, put out a statement to the American people on the passing of this milestone. Here's the former vice president.
Today is one of those moments. 100,000 lives have now been lost to this virus, each one leaving behind a family that will never again be whole. I think I know what you're feeling. You feel like you're being sucked into a black hole in the middle of your chest. It's suffocating. Your heart is broken. There's nothing but a feeling of emptiness right now. To all of you who are hurting so badly, I'm so sorry for your loss. I know there's nothing I or anyone else can say or do to dull the sharpness of the pain you feel right now. But I can promise you from experience, the day will come when the memory of your loved one will bring a smile to your lips before it brings a tear to your eyes. My prayer for all of you is that day will come sooner rather than later. But I promise you it will come. And when it does, you know you can make it.
Obviously speaking from his own tragic personal experience, and yet, Addie, it was almost like the president didn't want to acknowledge this. It was only 2 days later that in a tweet he expressed condolences to the families of the 100,000 lives that were lost. I mean, what's going on with Donald Trump? It's like he doesn't want to accept the reality.
I think he also doesn't want to accept the responsibility. I think that acknowledging the mass death would require Trump to self-reflect about how his administration has handled this crisis as it unfolded in the U.S. And, you know, it's pretty clear to everyone at this point that they did not take the coronavirus as seriously as they should have. And it absolutely, I think he doesn't want to accept the reality and he doesn't want to accept the responsibility.
Nor does he want to wear a mask, obviously.
Right? Absolutely not.
Which he has shown on several occasions. So what the president would like to do, of course, is change the subject. And I'd like to mention three ways he tried to change the subject this way, get your reaction to each of them. First of all, he pivoted to Barack Obama, not just blaming Barack Obama for the pandemic, but accusing Barack Obama of, quote, the greatest political crime in U.S. history. Jason, please tell us, what was this crime?
I have to say that, you know, when it comes to the so-called Obamagate, Donald Trump is perhaps the greatest postmodern novelist I've ever read because I can't figure out the plot, but I know it's there somewhere.
Sam, any idea what he's talking about?
No, and I've, you know, like just personally, I've been covering coronavirus and spending all my time on that and kept seeing these, you know, a tweet here or there, Obamagate. Finally, one night I was like, I got to figure out what he's talking about here. And like, sit down and, you know, I must have just missed it, whatever it was. I got just as lost as Jason. I'm just going to stop trying to figure this out. I don't think it can be figured out.
Okay, well, so then, Eddie, the other thing the president's pivoted to is we cannot have anybody vote by mail because that just means massive fraud and a rigged election, and I'm going to prevent any state from allowing people to vote by mail.
Oh, what? Yeah, absolutely. And I think I said this last time we talked. This vote by mail thing has been an obsession of his for months at this point. But one thing he often argues is that vote by mail states are overwhelmingly Democratic. I am from Utah. there is no world where someone would describe Utah as overwhelmingly Democratic. They don't love Trump the way a lot of Republican states do, but they are certainly not a liberal state, and it is a full vote by mail state. And I love to just remind people of that because there is no rhyme or reason or logic or reality to the president's attacks on vote by mail. That's it.
Period. Right. And I think we can period, full stop, whatever Sean Spicer said. And I think we can leave it at that. The other pivot on Donald Trump's part, trying to change the subject, which is not so funny, is from the Rose Garden, from the presidential podium, standing in back of the presidential seal, the president of the United States accused Joe Scarborough of murdering an intern who worked in his office, Florida office, 19 years ago, a totally baseless story that he has dredged up and repeated for 3 days straight from the White House. And Jason, number one, your comment on that. And then on Twitter, on that case, doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, and who knows if that was one of the things that snapped, you know, Twitter into looking at some of the other things. I mean, when I first heard that there was a warning label or a fact check on Trump's tweets, I assumed it was the Scarborough stuff. And then I was surprised to see that it was the vote by mail claims. This is one of these weird conspiracy theories that Scarborough killed this intern and that's why he retired. And, you know, it's kind of like the Vince Foster stuff to me. You know, it's just this thing that will never go away, or the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, I think that this is one of those, you know, I don't know if it really moves the needle so much anymore in terms of like where people's heads are about this. People, you know, like either love Scarborough or hate him, or they don't even know who he is most likely. I think that this is just one of those, like, you know, I mean, the president has a number of dog whistles that he can pick up at any moment, you know, a break in case of 100,000 deaths in coronavirus.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, he tried this one out and, you know, it had the added benefit of pissing off Scarborough and Mike Brzezinski. And then, you know, for him, you know, he got a crisis in Minneapolis. So it's like that he feels much more comfortable with. You know, it's just like this, he has this tool, you know, this tool shed filled with these sort of distractometers, and, you know, he just deploys them every once in a while.
Addie, how does the president believe that this would help him politically?
Bill, the fact that you would like me to get into Donald Trump's brain and explain it to you.
Or let me just ask you, does this help him politically? It's hard to see how.
I don't know. Here's what I will say. I think he gets bored. Honestly, I think he gets bored. And I think he likes to rile up his base. I think that he thinks it's fun to attack cable news, anchors in particular. Like, I don't think it helps him politically. I don't think there's any logic to it.
And maybe we should stop looking for logic to it. So, Sam.
Yes.
Sam, the president's response after Twitter put fact checks on his two statements about voter fraud, and now this morning put a fact check on his inciting violence in Minneapolis, or a warning. His response yesterday was to sign an executive order saying we're going to clamp down on social media. and we're going to basically maybe take away their liability, so to take away their protection, so they're going to be liable for any untruths or any libelous attacks that appear on their sites. This was Donald Trump's executive action. Sam, I don't know. When I look at that, it seems to me that could come back and bite Donald Trump in the butt, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he's the one who puts more of this stuff out there than anybody else.
Right. The actions, I mean, I don't think much will come of them. But, you know, if the things that he's talking about actually happened, all of the either the legal requirement or just the incentive would be for these platforms to police the content that users post more. And to exercise more what some people would call discretion and others would call censorship, but like, you know, get more involved in what can be posted and what can't. And it is things like accusing Joe Scarborough of murder that they will look for first.
Right. And Jason, it seems to me that there's a parallel here with Donald Trump and television. I mean, he is who he is because of television. And yet he spends half of his time attacking the TV networks, right? And he is who he is largely because of Twitter. And now he's attacking Twitter. We got a little pattern here.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable because, I mean, and that was one of the things that I thought also when, you know, when all the chatter started about this executive order, which apparently has been, you know, the red button he's wanted to push for a long time, if you believe the coverage about it being under consideration for, you know, as long as a year. No one has benefited more politically from social media than Donald Trump. And I think, you know, you and Sam are right. Absolutely. That this is the kind of thing, like, be careful what you ask for. because, you know, this is the way I've always felt about, you know, some of the threats to investigate Obamagate, for instance, is that if you really want to bring, you know, folks from the intelligence community into an open hearing to talk about Russian interference in the 2016 election, well, guess who that might hurt more than I don't think anybody gives a crap about like what Jim Comey is doing these days, but it certainly could reflect poorly on them and the president who they're ostensibly trying to protect. So yeah, I think that there is a potential for backlash but it is a part of the pattern. You know, I mean, like the Trump uses a shotgun, you know, when a lot less is called for.
Right. All right. Let's take a little break here with our panel, Addie Baird, Sam Baker, and Jason Dick here on the Bill Press Pod. And then we'll get back and welcome Joe Biden to the mix. It is the Bill Press Pod and this week's roundtable. This week's roundtable brought to you by the Teamsters Union, the great men and women of the United, the Brotherhood of Teamsters under the leadership of President Jim Hoffa, a real powerhouse among American labor unions, the largest and the most powerful of our labor unions, representing everyone, they say, from A to Z, everyone from airline pilots to zookeepers. We salute the members of the Teamsters. They are on the front lines, particularly those truck drivers during the time of this coronavirus pandemic, delivering America's goods that we need to keep going. So we salute them for their good work and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we're back with this week's roundtable. Addie Baird from BuzzFeed, Sam Baker from Axios, and Jason Dick from a Roll Call. We did see Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, emerge from his basement this week, laying a wreath at the memorial at the Delaware Memorial Bridge to the veterans who've lost their lives in America's wars, wearing a mask, as was his wife, Jill Biden, wearing a mask. And he called Donald Trump actually a fool for not wearing his mask and criticizing Joe Biden for wearing a mask. Addie, this is the new get tough Joe Biden?
I guess so. I feel like every question you've asked me this morning, I'm like, I don't know, Bill. There's no rhyme or reason to the world. But I do think that the mask war is a bit funny and one of the most ridiculous because it's about saving lives and keeping people healthy. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, Trump has just refused to wear a mask every time he goes to, you know, tour an auto plant or, you know, every time he travels, you see these pictures of everyone around him wearing a mask. And then you get a statement from the White House of, oh, he was wearing a mask backstage. And then he took it off so that he could, you know, speak more clearly. You know, the fact of the matter is, and it's always interesting when you see some of the president's, you know, defenders really say the thing that some of the people in his administration won't. And so many people who, you know, are allies of the president's said that Joe Biden's mask just looked dumb. And that to me is really what it's all about for Trump. He just is so aware of his image and so aware of how he looks all the time. And he thinks masks look dumb and won't wear one.
So, Sam, you're the expert here. I mean, just for the record, wearing a mask is a good idea, right?
Yes. This is okay. A very frustrating part of the politics of the coronavirus. Wear the mask. Like, I know it kind of sucks. I don't like it either. It's better than getting coronavirus or giving someone else coronavirus. Wear the
and
mask.
Social distancing has proven to work, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So that even as states open up, it's important just not to go back to business as usual, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so frustrating about it is like there is a way to safely partially reopen. Like, I want to get out of my apartment too. I understand that. You know, we can't lock down forever. But there are things you have to do in order to get the reopening that you want. And if you won't do those things, then none of this works. Right.
Jason, one thing that is keeping Joe Biden busy in that basement, and one good reason for not going out more, maybe, is he's got a vice presidential running mate to choose. We talked earlier that Amy Klobuchar may no longer be on the list. What do your sources tell you who's up and who's down?
You know, this has been one of those confounding things that, like, you know, because we don't have as much time on the road and time with political operatives face to face, you know, people will tell you things in person that they won't tell you over the phone or they won't tell you on, you know, over email. But I mean, this seems like, you know, unlike, you know, the Trump, you know, vice presidential selection process, this seems to be going, you know, kind of by the numbers. They're doing background checks. They're looking at, you know, people like Kamala Harris. They're looking at people like Stacey Abrams. I mean, he's, you know, said that he's going to pick a woman. And I can't help but think that Klobuchar was, you know, fairly high on the list for, you know, most of this year until a couple days ago. But, you know, it's, I mean, that takes some of the, you know, the steam out of it, I guess, is for lack of a better term, that, you know, we know it'll be a woman, and we know it'll probably be somebody who Biden, you know, given his age and given questions about, you know, how long, whether he would serve a second term, needs to be somebody viewed as like, yeah, this person could be the, you know, the next president afterwards. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's in that crew, that fairly small crew, of senators, people who have run for president, like Elizabeth Warren, and people like Abrams and Kamala Harris.
What do you, Stacey Abrams has ran for governor, not for president, of course, but, Addie, what do you hear? What do your sources tell you?
You know, Jason's absolutely right. It's sort of it's a hard time because like we were talking before we started recording, I haven't been to Capitol Hill since March, and it's harder to connect with sources, but I think Jason is on the money. I think Biden has been pretty clear about the kind of running mate that he wants to pick. He wants a woman. I think that increasingly it's likely that that woman will be a person of color. There's absolutely an argument for Elizabeth Warren, and I can't quite get a sense of, you know, whether she is someone that Biden really wants to run with. But there has been some really interesting polling about the way that she can bring in young voters, which Joe Biden certainly needs. She absolutely could help bridge the divide in the Democratic Party, you know, between mainstream Democrats and progressives. And I think she would be a really interesting choice. But I think especially given kind of the moment that we are in, and how we started this conversation today, talking about racial and police violence, I think that it's probably pretty likely, you know, that Biden will end up going with a woman of color on the ticket.
And Sam, if you talk about, here we come home to Boston and Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, the one obstacle that, and by the way, great Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg this week put out a column saying Elizabeth Warren is the one, she would be the best one for Biden. But there's a guy in Massachusetts by the name of, I guess, your cousin, Charlie Baker.
No relation.
Charlie Baker, who happens to be a Republican governor, who probably, were she chosen and elected, would appoint a Republican senator. Big problem.
Huh? I don't think that is actually a big problem. Because Democrats in the state legislature, I believe, have a supermajority, where they could pass and then override a veto of a bill requiring him to pick someone from the same party. I believe they could do that.
They could do that, right. And I think you're right from what I know about the majority in the state legislature. So that could be their backup.
Yeah, so I think, you know,
right?
I think if it's her, the Democrats who control the state of Massachusetts, except for the one office of the governor, will do whatever they can to ensure that a Democrat replaces her.
All right. Tell your cousin, watch out. We got that. By the way, just for the sake of the discussion, I wrote my own column this week suggesting that Susan Rice would have outstanding credentials, maybe the best of anybody, in terms of experience in the White House and experience in making things happen at the federal level of any of the other nominees. And I know she's under consideration too. Just one question about the Senate. Whether Republicans are getting nervous by following Donald Trump 100% and looking at some of their Senate races, maybe a year ago everybody said it was pretty clear there was no way the Democrats could pick up the Senate. Do you think it's looking any better for Democrats today on the Senate? Jason, start with you.
It absolutely is. And, you know, this has been one of the big, you know, changes in the political dynamics. I mean, you know, the White House is, you know, this is still unstable territory and most likely a very close race that probably favors Biden. The House is most likely going to stay Democratic just because of the playing field. But the Senate, I mean, you're right. A year ago, we did not think that there was a huge chance that Democrats could pick it up. But, you know, a few things happened. One, you know, even before the pandemic struck, you know, the candidates matter, and Democrats got a really good crop of candidates. And, you know, if you would have told me, I mean, I'm from Arizona. If you would have told me that Martha McSally was going to, you know, just be completely blown out of the water by somebody who really didn't have that much of a connection to Arizona, aside from being, you know, married to Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman, you know, I would have said, like, I don't know. It seems like McSally would probably learn from some of the mistakes she made in the 2018 race against Kyrsten Sinema, self-correct, be, you know, fully funded and you know, really make it close and kind of, you know, probably win the rest of the term. And that has just not happened. Mark Kelly has outraised her by crazy amounts of money and is kind of running away with that race. In North Carolina, you know, the Democrats got a great candidate in Cal Cunningham. And he's, you know, the type of person you have to run in a state like North Carolina, a Southern swing state, if you will, to get. And then, you know, things you just hadn't really anticipated that Steve Bullock would completely turn around the dynamics of the race in Montana and start to give Steve Daines a race. So, right. You know, and I'm sorry. Yeah. One thing is they've expanded the playing field, and they might not win all the races, but they certainly are going to make Republicans sweat it out and make, you know, spend a lot of money.
And Sam, one other state close to you that everybody's been looking at, is the state of Maine, with Susan Collins perhaps in trouble for the very first time. And the latest poll in her career, the latest poll I showed Sarah Gideon ahead of Susan Collins, 51-42.
Yeah, I imagine Susan Collins is actually concerned. Her
and
her forever mood is probably very much her mood right now. And Cory Gardner, too, in Colorado, looks like he's got a real tough race. So yeah, people who, you know, I guess to Jason's point, there's sort of two things happening with the map in states like Maine and Colorado. It's like firming up that blue states are blue all the way around, and then also expanding the map into states like North Carolina and Arizona, which is where you want to be.
So, Eddie, one sleeper race is and the state of Kentucky, with Senate leader Mitch McConnell up for re-election, up against Amy McGrath. I thought it was very interesting yesterday that the Lincoln Project, these are the non-Trumper Republicans led by George Conway and Rick Wilson, among others, who are very much out to dethrone Donald Trump and actually supporting Joe Biden. But they've gotten involved in the Senate race in Kentucky against Mitch McConnell, and they released an ad, anti-McConnell ad yesterday, about all the money that Mitch McConnell has made as Senate leader. Here's the Lincoln Project ad.
What will history say about Mitch McConnell? Well, he spent most of his time making deals for himself, not so much for Kentucky. Mitch didn't have money when he went to Washington 35 years ago. Today, he's one of the richest guys up there. Rich Mitch has a nice ring to it. So what did Kentucky get in the bargain? Well, we're 40th in job opportunity, 45th in education, 43rd in health care. Getting the picture? With another 6 years of Mitch McConnell, from the holler to the horse farm, we'll still be waiting. And Mitch, he'll just be richer.
Whoa, Addie, I want those guys on my side. I never want them against me, right?
Well, it's so interesting because, like you said, they're anti-Trump Republicans. And I think that it makes all the sense in the world when you of course, it's a bit surprising. But I think it makes all the sense in the world. If you really want to hurt Trump, taking down Mitch McConnell is a really good way to do that. Mitch McConnell is absolutely Trump's biggest enabler. He has really spent the Trump presidency just confirming Trump's judges, which I think will be one of Trump's biggest legacies, is the way that he has reshaped the federal bench. And it makes a lot of sense if you want to push back against Donald Trump. Trying to take down Mitch McConnell is a really smart way to do that. And that ad is good. It's a good ad.
Rich Mitch. It does have a little ring. It does have a ring to it. Well, we've gone a little longer than we normally do. But you know what? We had a lot to talk about. So thank you so much, Addie Baird, Sam Baker, and Jason Dick for joining us on today's panel. But we don't let you go and won't let you go before we ask you, was there any one story this week that kind of captured your attention, made you stop and say, wow, look at that. You want to share with us, Jason?
Yeah, and this is a little bittersweet, and it's not on a global scale, but it's something that, you know, it definitely affects the dining patterns of me and you, Bill.
And that's
Emily Hiles' kind of appreciation in the Washington Post of the closing of Montmartre and Seventh Hill, these two restaurants side by side owned by the same guys. One was a kind of traditional country French restaurant, a bistro, and then the other was a pizza place. And, you know, it's one casualty among many in small businesses due to the pandemic. And it had been there for 20 years. You know, restaurants usually don't make it that long, but it was just such a kick in the stomach, to me in more ways than one. I really grieved, you know, when I heard about Montmartre, and I thought Emily did a really, you know, kind of just a great job of, you know, illustrating why it was an important place, because it was so not fancy. It was just a place people gathered and people felt at home. And it really made me stop, you know, and think, because, you know, you can get overwhelmed with numbers and tweets and things like that. But this was hit home on a personal level. And I thought Emily did a great job in summing up why it was an important thing.
Indeed. And as a fellow Hillite, I also share the loss. Been to Montmartre many, many times. But it was symbolic of what is happening all around the country. And everybody in every neighborhood is going to have a story like that. I'm afraid that to say, I've seen numbers that as many as one third of the restaurants may never reopen. Yeah. And they're going to be among them a lot of our favorites. Sam, what caught your attention this week?
I finally found a coronavirus side effect that I have absolutely no sympathy for. And that is a story in the Wall Street Journal. It's a tough time to be a fan of bats. This is a story of bat lovers who feel put upon. Their neighbors now don't want them to put out little bat houses to attract bats in their yard. And I say, yeah, it's a hard time to be a fan of bats. That is a correct response. And you guys need to just read the room and chill and be quiet about bats for a while. The originators of this global pandemic. We're against them in the moment, and that's fine.
that hits home because one of our sons is a great fan of bats, so I'll have to tell David to calm down here.
And what
I know they're important; they pollinate a lot of flowers and everything. But just
and
pick your moment.
And just guess, Batman is going to be next, right? You know, there will be some sort of Batman angle next in pop culture.
One of the people quoted in this story is vehemently anti-Batman. Because he made his life off of a fear of bats. It's just, you guys gotta calm down.
So, Addie, help us out here with your favorite story.
I have no idea how to follow that one. So I will say I have had a week of reading a lot less news than normal because the BuzzFeed News Union has been in bargaining meetings with our management all week over cost saving and job saving measures. I'm on our bargaining committee, and so I've been doing that all day, every day. And so I thought I would take this moment to say, unionize your workplace. But mm-hmm. there was one thing I read this week in between that that made me smile. I'm a huge Katie Weaver fan, who is now writing at the New York Times. And she wrote a piece this week that is headlined "To Compare an Apple to a Submarine." And the sort of premise of this piece is that the founder of Quibi recently said that it was ridiculous to compare Quibi, this, you know, recently launched short video app, to TikTok. He said it's like comparing an apple to a submarine. So Katie Weaver, in classic Katie Weaver fashion, said, "All right, I will compare an apple to a submarine." And for several thousand words, you know, did some reporting, talked to an expert on apples and an expert on submarines, and compared them for thousands of words in the New York Times. And you know, sort of comes to this verdict about how you can indeed compare apples to submarines. Right. And it's just really great. It's classic Katie Weaver, and I encourage everyone to read it.
I'm going to go back and read it, but to me it just proves that, that it is true during this coronavirus pandemic. Some people have too much time on their hands, right?
Yes. So,
well, thank you all. My favorite story is not my favorite story. It's really my least favorite story of the week, but I want to mention it anyhow. And that is the news we got this week that CBS News is letting Mark Knoller go. Mark Knoller, for those of you, I'm sure any of you who follow the White House, know Mark Knoller. You know his voice. It's a very distinct voice. And you know his reporting. In my time at the White House, Mark Knoller was one of the guys, one of the real best reporters in the room. One of the guys you could always depend on. He asked the most penetrating questions on behalf of CBS News. And he was the resident librarian, if you will. Anytime you needed to know any little factlet, like how many times Obama had played golf, he knew it right on the tip of his tongue. How many times Obama had failed to answer a question about gun control, Mark Knoller would know it. You could ask him how many times Barack Obama had worn that particular tie, Mark Knoller would know it. All those kind of into little factlets that colored everybody's reporting, and Mark Knoller was the source and generously shared his research with anybody in the Washington Press Corps. So Mark Knoller, we won't be hearing from him anymore. Fortunately, he is not a victim of the coronavirus pandemic, but unfortunately, he is a victim of the stupidity of CBS News. So here to Mark Knoller. And thank you, Addie Baird. Thank you, Jason Dick from Roll Call. Thank you, Sam Baker. Quickly, how can people follow you and find you, Jason?
It's I'm on Twitter at Jason J. Dick.
Okay. And Sam Baker?
I am at Sam _ Baker.
At Sam _ Baker. How about you, Addie Baird?
I am on Twitter at Addie S. Baird.
There you go. And you can find me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod, at Bill Press Pod. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks to our panel. We hope that if you... Well, do us a favor, if you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the Bill Press Pod. That really helps us out. Just wherever you're listening to this podcast, pull up the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, you are in, tell your friends to do all the same, and follow all of us on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod. Our next podcast, early next week, with Bakari Sellers from CNN, who has a new book out called My Vanishing Country. Looking forward to that. Looking forward to seeing all of you again on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.